Today's Teisho will be on case 25 in the Heikigan Roku, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 25 is entitled The Master of Rengeho's Staff. Engo's Introduction. If the action of one's ki is not independent of one's degree of enlightenment, one falls into a sea of poison. If one's words do not astonish the crowd, one slips into the conventional. If you can distinguish black from white in the moment of a spark's being struck, and can tell life from death in the instant of a flash of lightning, then you will be able to command all quarters and stand firm like a 1,000-fathom cliff. Who could ever be like that? See the following. Main subject, the master of Rengeho Cottage, held out his staff and said to his disciples, when in olden times a man reached the state of enlightenment, why did he not remain there? No one could answer. And he replied for them, because it is of no use in the course of life. And he asked again, after all, what will you do with it? And once again he said in their stead, taking no notice of others, throwing his staff over his shoulder, he goes straight ahead and journeys deep into the recesses of the 100,000 mountains. Secho's verse, his eyes filled with sand, his ears with clay, even among the 1,000 mountains he does not remain. Falling blossoms, flowing streams, he leaves no trace. Open your eyes wide and you'll wonder where he's gone. There was a teacher, a practitioner of Zen, known as the Master of Rengeho Cottage. He lived in a remote area and practiced Zazen in the tradition of forest-dwelling hermits. This is an ancient tradition. It goes back to India, to the forest-dwelling rishis of India. People who would leave behind their homes and their families and their society. And they would live in the forest and cultivate awakened mind. When the Buddha left his family and went to inquire into the nature of sickness, old age, and death, he went to live with people such as these. In Tibetan Buddhism, there are many stories of people living in caves. Milarepa lived in a cave for a long time and practiced Zazen, practiced seated meditation. In the Chinese tradition as well, you have these people who live by themselves in seclusion, often in the fastness of the mountains, in the remoteness of the mountains. The great Zen master Shuyun lived that way for many years, and his hut is still there. In fact, there's probably somebody sitting in it right now, seriously, doing Zazen. One such person is called the Master of Rengeho Cottage. Even though he's not the head of a temple, even though he's living in a remote place, apparently some people have come up to practice with him. And you can imagine how difficult that is. You know, you have to leave things behind, go up into the mountains, and you know, it sounds nice, the Rengeho cottage, but I'm sure there's no heat. It's probably a rough life. Bill Porter, a man who writes under the name Red Pine, he's a really wonderful translator of Chinese Buddhist literature. Actually, after the opening up of China in the 80s, he went around China looking for people who were living up in the mountains in this way, and he was told by all the government officials that nobody was left, that the Cultural Revolution and the Mao years had pretty much wiped out this whole tradition of people living in remote places and practicing the way. And then he went up to the mountains himself, especially these areas that were famous for people living in these huts. And he found them all over the place. He found Taoists and Buddhists. He found men. He found women. He found young people and old people. So it was quite remarkable that this tradition is still there. And people like this, people who are willing to do this, are really unusual people, you know, because they've really, really said goodbye to the world of human affairs in a certain way, you know. You know, when you, if you take the traditional path of, say, monkhood, or you become a bhikshu or a bhikshuni, you know, you are saying goodbye to your family, to your traditional place in society. You're living in a community of practitioners. You generally get a new name that says you have closed the door on your old life, and you become basically a new person, a member of a new community or a new family. And this is ancient practice that goes back to the time of the Buddha. But people like this are even even more, what shall we say, courageous, or they have a very even more they're even more willing to give things up, you could say. And so they live up in the mountains with really no support system at all, you know. Bodhidharma did this when he came to China. He lived in a cave and somehow didn't starve to death. People heard that there was this holy man living up in the mountains, and they would bring him food. So anyway, this man, the master of Rengeho Cottage, is living by himself up in the mountains, and apparently people have just said, okay, I have nothing on my schedule for the rest of my life. I'm going to go up and study with the master of the Rengeho Cottage, you know. And that's such people are really extraordinary, you know, really extraordinary people. You know, just willing to say, okay, I'm going to go live in the mountains, and I don't know what's going to happen to me. And basically, I may never see anybody I know again, but I'm going to do it. You know, that's really an extraordinary person. So, apparently, people have taken this step. You know, they heard, you know, there's a guy living up in the mountains, just like Bodhidharma. And he is he's a solitary practitioner, deeply awake. And they go up and they live with him, you know, and you share his hut, or you sleep outside the hut. And it's cold in the winter and it's hot in the summer. And you know, you go pick dandelion greens and you stir-fry dandelion greens, and you have dirt under your fingernails, and you know, you forget what a bath is, you know, this sort of thing. And you live a long time like that with the master of Rengeho Cottage. And then one day he gives a talk. And he says something very strange. He said, you know, in the old days, when a person reached the state of enlightenment, why did he not remain there? When in old times a man reached the state of enlightenment, why did he not remain there? And that's such a strange statement, isn't it? Because when we think of enlightenment, we think of it as like the final destination. So he says, when in olden times a man reached the state of enlightenment, why did he not remain there? And when he pitches that question, there are no takers. No one could answer, and he answered himself. Because enlightenment is of no use in the course of life. Now that's don't you think that's an extraordinary thing to say? I mean, when we think about enlightenment, we think, oh, what a precious jewel, right? What a precious jewel. We think of the master of Rengeho's, you know, staff, Rengeho Cottage, maybe has sacrificed many, many things in his life in order to have enlightenment. And we might expect him to say, oh, I've given up so many things in my life. You know, I've given up so many things. But it was worth it because it's so precious. And what he says instead, he says it's of no use in the course of life. And again, he asked them, so what do you do with enlightenment? What do we do with enlightenment? And again, nobody can answer. And so he recites a little poem. He says, taking no notice of others, throwing his staff over his shoulder, he goes straight ahead and journeys deep into the recesses of the 100,000 mountains. This is such a great koan, don't you think? Because it really turns things on their head. You know, there are a lot of books at the bookstore on Zen. And they come at Zen from many different angles. And many of them are oriented towards using Zen to improve your life. Right? This is understandable, right? You know. There are books that the books that I haven't read that might be useful. And there's a book, you know, on the Zen of tennis. You know, the Zen. There was a book called The Zen of Driving. There are books on like Zen investment. You know, and there are books on Zen cooking. You know, and the message, in a way, is that if you do Zen, you will live a better life. You know, you'll have a better life, and that Zen can be like applied to your life, and it can be, it can make your life better. Now, this makes so much sense, right? It just makes, why would we do anything that didn't make our lives better? And especially, I think, in the modern world and in the United States, this just seems self-evident, right? You would naturally want to do something that would enhance your life, that would make you able to be more effective, more competitive, more intelligent, and so on and so on. And yet, you know, the master of Rengeho Cottage says that enlightenment won't do any of those things. I remember when I was training with Genki Roshi, there was a baseball player whose name I think was Oh. I might be misremembering his name, but I think his name was Sadaharu Oh. Is that right? I can't remember his name, but he was quite a famous baseball player in Japan. And he had gone into a slump, And he was really like, he was like the Mickey Mantle of Japan or the Derek Jeter of Japan. And he was really famous. And then he went into this bad slump. And he decided, and Genki Roshi said, after he was in this slump for quite a while, he became depressed, and understandably. And he became quite unhappy. And he went into a Zen monastery, which is a very Japanese thing to do, right? And so he decided to try to change his karma and change his life by going into a monastery and doing zazen. And Genki always told that story, and basically that was the end of the story. And then he went into a Zen monastery, and finally somebody actually asked him. Did he come out? You know, he came out of the monastery, right? And he got out of his slump, right? And Genki Roshi laughed. He said, "No, not really. No. He didn't really get out of his slump." Now, I think that's a disappointing ending to the story. What we were supposed to hear is that he would go into the monastery, reformulate himself, and come out and knock the ball out of the park. And that would be a wonderful story, but sometimes life doesn't work that way. Now, the thing about, I think that Zen is really quite wonderful, and I do think it helps in many ways. But I think there's something about Zen which is really special, because it is useless. You know, it really is truly useless. And I think part of the reason our society is so unhappy and so unhealthy is because we don't appreciate the value of uselessness. The other day I was listening to a travel program. When I drive up to Blairstown on Sunday, I often listen to a radio show with a man named Rick Steves. And he has a lovely radio program. He goes all over the world. And he was in southern Italy. And he had on this very sophisticated, well-educated Italian woman. And she was sort of explaining Italian culture. She was telling Steve about Italian culture, and she was saying that one of the key concepts in Italian culture is this idea of, and I'm not going to pronounce this right, but it was dolce far niente. I'm sure I'm not getting it right. Dolce far niente. But it means the sweetness of doing nothing. Yeah? Dolce far niente. I'm sure my Italian isn't any better than my Chinese, you know. So, but this is very wise, in my opinion. And by the way, I might be arrested in the United States for saying such a thing, right? Because we're all like the descendants of the Puritans, even though we didn't all come from New England. That the idea that you should be, every spare minute should be spent in some purposeful activity is drilled into our heads in a million ways. And often we feel quite guilty if we're not doing something that's contributing to what should we say, the forward motion of the human race, you know. And so, you know, this idea, this Italian idea, dolce far niente, the sweetness of doing nothing, is very suspicious to Americans, I think, and also to Northern Europeans in general. But it's also very wise, you know, very wise. We construct imaginary goals and imaginary purposes. And this is very important for us as human beings, you know. And it can be liberating, right? I mean, so I like painting. And I enjoy the visual arts so much, and I was looking at some wonderful paintings the other day. My wife bought me a book recently on Mexican muralists, and Orozco, Siqueiros, and Rivera. And I actually love their work. If you think about it, what they're doing is they're taking pigments and putting it on a surface, right? And it's creating an illusion, and that's what they're doing, you know. And this is very ancient. It's something humans did long, long ago. On my computer at work, I have an image of a bison that's 30,000 years old. It's from the Lascaux Caves in France. And it's beautiful. It's, you know, modern artists couldn't do any better than that. It's absolutely beautiful. So this hunger to represent things is sort of hardwired into us, right? And generation after generation, people have this desire to paint and to take pigments and put them on surfaces and create these beautiful forms. And you know, there's no reason to do this. You know, there's no reason to do this. We could say, well, you're contributing to the human race, or you're expressing something, you know, a higher something. But actually, we do it because it's fun, right? I mean, painting is beautiful. It's fun. It's interesting. It makes you feel alive if you're a painter, and if you like art. You know, it makes you feel alive, you know. And I find these things incredibly exciting. But there's no reason to do it other than that it makes us feel more alive, see. And the interesting thing is that, you know, somebody like Siqueiros or somebody like Diego Rivera, he was like a born painter. He was been painting, drawing, painting all his life since he was a little kid. And he would get up in the morning and just do it all day long. And I think it was quite natural for him. But, you know, he also had like a competitive streak. And so, you know, basically it began to make his art life as an artist unhappy, because he wasn't always painting naturally. You know, sometimes he was worried about what other people were doing. And so he and Siqueiros had a very tense relationship, because they were competing with each other. They both probably stayed up at night worrying about what the other person was going to do. What I'm getting at is that there's a way of living. There's a way of living which is not really purposive. It's unfolding naturally, and when you live that way, you're not moving towards a goal. You're just being fully present, and the outcome isn't important. And this is difficult to achieve, you know. I was just reading about this Australian poet, and he has lived all his life on a farm in Australia, and he's written these extraordinary poems, and they're about chickens, they're about clouds, you know. And, you know, it's possible to say that he wrote these poems because he wanted to make a contribution to, you know, the history of poetry but really I think he wrote these poems because writing poems made him feel more alive. And you know, many poets get depressed because they want to share their work and they want their work to be appreciated. And this is very healthy. I mean, wanting to do something beautiful and let other people share it with you is a healthy, normal human impulse. But you know, actually, poetry can be ruined by the desire to become a famous poet. You know, so every year they give awards in poetry. And all kinds of really wonderful books don't get poetry awards, you know? And so you'll have 50 really wonderful books, and if you read them, they're all very good, and one of them will get an award. And it's good to give somebody an award. It's good to say to somebody, hey, your work is really good. But on the other hand, you know, you might not get the award and you might go home and you might be very unhappy because you feel like, you know, I'm writing these poems and apparently there's something wrong with them, you know. And this kind of thinking really poisons the beauty and spontaneity of the life of the poet, you know. So what I'm getting at is that we often get tangled up in a world which is quite artificial. And we sometimes lose this spontaneity and naturalness, which it comes from knowing, or comes from that place where there is no purpose. It's the dolce far niente. The sweetness of doing nothing. The sweetness of doing nothing. You know, Zen has no purpose. It has no purpose. You will achieve nothing. And this is really, if you think about it, quite, you know, I mean, there are many people come to Zen. And they don't understand it, but it helps them, you know? I myself was like that. I had a lot of problems when I was younger. And I started sitting, and I didn't know why, but I felt so much better after sitting, even though my legs killed me. You know? So some of you are here for the first time, and I know you're struggling, you know? If this is your first session, everybody's been there. And by the way, I put some chairs against the wall. You know, if you reach a point where you just can't deal with your discomfort anymore, please feel free to get up during one of the sitting periods and just take a breather on the cushion. I mean, on the chair, and then you can come back to the cushion after you've had a little rest. So anyway, please don't be ashamed to use the chair, because everybody here has probably used the chair at one time or another. But people come to Zazen, and it is challenging in a lot of ways. But it can be so deeply liberating, and people don't know why. They don't know why. I have been, this last year has been a really challenging year for me. I've had many things going on in my life that were really challenging. And among other things, I've had to struggle with budget cuts, and these have been very difficult for me to deal with, because, people I care about have been suffering. One of the reasons we had to change the schedule for this session was because a person who used to work in my office no longer works in my office. And I used to be able to ask that person to take over for me at the end of the week during spring break. And now that person is gone, and this year I had to move the schedule for session so that I could be there on Friday and Thursday. It's been a challenging year for me, and there's all kinds of, where I work, there's politics, and there's all kinds of ego games and things like that. And even though you might think of English departments as like a very peaceful place, You know, they are. I mean, what could be more peaceful, right? I mean, even though you might think of an English department as a place where people are dedicated to the arts, to beauty, why wouldn't everybody get along, you know? But actually, that's not the case. You know, people find a way to make the atmosphere tense even there, you know? And anyway, I came in last night and sat down on the cushion. And I have to say, you know, I carried a lot of baggage with me to Sesshin. And I sat last night and I was really tired. I hope what I said last night, part of my job is to make opening remarks for the Sesshin. But usually by around 10:30, the night we arrive, I'm sort of delirious. So I hope they made some sense. But when I got up this morning and sat, I had a really great sit. And I got up and I went into the kitchen and my heart was just like singing. I just felt so damn good, you know. And it was because, you know, it was dolce far niente, right? It's like the sweetness of life, you know, with no goal. No goal, you know, and oh, it felt so good, right? It's, you know, letting it all go, letting it all go, all of it, and just being in the moment. It's so liberating, right? It just feels so good. It does, and I feel so alive. And I have to say, I don't, you know, I will keep doing my zazen, I promise. And I will keep trying to integrate my life off the cushion with my life on the cushion. But I must say that, you know, I have not off the cushion had this kind of extraordinary liberation, you know, that feeling of total release and total connection. You know, I don't necessarily get that in front of my word processor, you know, writing memos. I'll keep trying, right? But I sure get it on the cushion. So, you know, I got up this morning and I went into the kitchen and I just was singing, you know, not really, but I mean in my heart. And I felt so connected and so alive. And so happy just to be alive, you know, which was not how I came down here in my car feeling, you know. So this is quite extraordinary, you know. We know it's hard to for humans to admit, right? But basically, how shall I put it? I was listening a few years ago to Stephen Hawking. And Stephen Hawking has been getting stranger and stranger as he gets older. And he was talking about how the sun is going to expand. And he was actually worried about what we were going about. It's going to expand in a million years or something like that. Our sun is going to get very big in about a million years. And Hawking was saying, how will we get off the planet, right? And he was really, like, worried about it, you know? And he was planning our escape route, you know? And it's like, wait a minute, that's a million years from now, you know? I mean, there are very few sure bets in life, right? But there's one sure bet. There won't be humans in a million years. I mean, they certainly won't, if evolution continues, and it is, they certainly won't look like us now, you know? And, you know, it won't be, there won't be McDonald's, I would bet, in a million years, you know. There won't be, you know. So the thing is, his way of thinking is really absurd, right? I mean, nothing lasts a million years, not even a mountain, right? And species don't, you know, I mean, dinosaurs were around for a million years, but millions of years, but they weren't unchanged, right? And also we know, you know, that we've only been around for about 200,000 years, you know. So a million more years, it was actually millions. the question was just so absurd, and it occurs to me that we all do that, right? You know, we all do that, but in a certain sense, we also know that, you know, life is like a bubble, like a dream. It's like a sand painting. You know, that's what the Buddha says at the end of the Diamond Sutra. You know, our human life is like this. It's like this. He said it's over in an instant. And he said the whole world is like a dream or a bubble that's just here for a second and it's gone. And we know that's true. We know that's true on some level. It's like a game we play. You know, it's a game. This is a game we play. And we can play the game in a way that's lighthearted, but that's very hard. Or we can play the game in a way that becomes very serious. But when we become too serious, we become very, it becomes claustrophobic, doesn't it? It's like when you take things too seriously, it becomes claustrophobic. Everything becomes, it closes in on you. You become locked down and rigid and fearful. And so actually I find something incredibly liberating about imagining that, you know, it's all going to be dust. It's all just going to be dust someday. And I suppose that could be a depressing thought, but what it really means is you're absolutely free right now to be here. You know? There's no purpose to any of this. And so you're absolutely free to be present right now without any strings attached. This is so rare. Normally there's strings, right? You know, in almost every other aspect of life, there are these strings attached, where it's like, you know, how shall I put it? There was a movie a long time ago, a Monty Python movie, and one of the characters in it was Robin Hood. But Robin Hood was an English bureaucrat, and he was giving out presents to all the poor people. And he would call them up and hand them a bag of money, but then he had an assistant, and when the poor person would take the bag of money, his assistant would punch the poor person in the face. See? So these poor people are looking, they're all lined up for the money, and they're in this double bind, right? Because they want the money, but they don't want the punch. Right? This is like the modern world, right? You know, or maybe it's like the world of humans, you know, who knows? But each person, you know, it's incredibly brutal to see, because there's this, you know, there'll be some wizened old woman who looks like you could break her, just, and the guy just slugs her right in the face, you know, and it's like, oh my God, you know. And each time the person gets slugged, you know, he says, thank you, you know, John Cleese is the bureaucrat, he goes, thank you, you know. And, you know, but life is, those are the strings, right? It's like, you know, But I think Zazen is like getting the present with no slug in the face, you know? It's like, it's absolutely a gift, a pure gift, you know? There's no expectation of return. That's so rare, and it's so liberating, I think, and so healing. You know, normally, we judge and are judged, right? We judge and are judged. You walk into a room, you look at somebody, you size them up, you sum them up, they do it to you. And immediately there might be a contest of wills, there's a hunger for recognition, there's all of this dynamic that's very subtle, but it's going on constantly. And you know, people can become phobic. They can develop, you know, all kinds of defense mechanisms. They can become arrogant. You know, I mean, you see it every day. You see somebody walk into a room, and the person is, you know, bound and determined to feel superior to everybody else in the room. And the person's struggling from the minute he opens his mouth or she opens her mouth to be the master of the situation. And there are other people who are intimidated or fearful, you know. So these human relations are very complicated. But when you come here and you sit down on the cushion, it returns us to the moment where, you know, somebody first picked up a piece of chalk and started writing on a cave wall and making a bison picture, you know. There weren't any awards for bison pictures then, you know. And somebody might have thought, why are you doing that? It's totally useless, you know. And the artist might have said, oh, I don't know why I'm doing it myself, but it feels so good, you know. And when I do it, when I think of these bison and I make these marks, I feel so alive, right? When people write poetry, you know, what they're really doing is something that makes them feel alive, you know, and it makes them feel connected. And then they don't get the poetry award, and then they start drinking and they get depressed, you know. But there's a moment there where it's just the pure joy of being alive. And if we're not careful, that gets lost. And so Zen people live in that freedom to a degree that maybe people don't always understand, you know. And also, even Zen people might not appreciate what they're doing, you know, how extraordinary. I think Sesshin is especially extraordinary, extraordinary. You know, there's nothing, I can't think of anything else like this in our culture. You know, last night, a very nice young woman came here, and she had been calling me all week to come to Sesshin. And I hope she'll come back. But she kept phoning me, and I would come home, and she'd be on my answering service, and she wrote me emails, but I've been so busy, and I finally called her up, and she said I wanted to come to Sesshin. And she came to Sesshin last night, and it totally freaked her out. I mean, it totally freaked her out. And she said, I actually feel ill, you know. And I said, well, you know, this is a new experience, you know, why not give it a try? And I said, you're free to leave. You know, it's not like anybody is going to try to stop you. I said, you can go anytime you want, but, you know, you're very young, you're 22 or 23. Why don't you try a new thing? You know, this is totally new. And I think it was frightening, you know, really frightening to her. And part of it, I think, was just psychologically, I think this resonated very deeply with her in ways that made her very nervous, you know. We're all going to sit here quietly, soundlessly for days, you know, and we're, you know, sitting motionless. And I asked her, is it the physical element that bothers you? And she said, no, it's something else. And she couldn't put her finger on it. But she was really freaked out. And I wish she had explored this, because she said, I actually feel a huge amount of fear right now. And I said, well, don't you think that would be worth exploring, your fear? But I just think it was a little too much too soon, you know. But not unusual, right? I mean, this kind of freedom is frightening in a certain way, right? To know that your life has no purpose, to know that your existence, there's no meaning to your existence, that there's no end game, that there's no, you know, these things sound like a nightmare, you know, actually, right? My God, my meaningless existence, my purposeless existence, you know. And when you get, you know, maybe you'll leave here and you'll get an envelope in the mail and it will say, you've won the poetry award, you know, the National Poetry Award. And you say, have a purpose. I'm not sure that's good for us, you know. Because, you know, next time you sit down to write, you're going to say, wait a minute, I just can't write a poem. It has to be the greatest poem ever written, right? It has to be as good as Baudelaire. You know, it has to be as good as, you know, Lorca, you know, or I'm a bum, you know. I don't deserve my prize. So you sit there and there's a blank piece of paper and you look up at your award and you think, I need a drink. And then you begin to develop a complex, right? And then, you know, this is familiar, right? And I'll wrap it up. But, you know, one of the writers I like, F. Scott Fitzgerald, you know, actually did become a very serious alcoholic, and it destroyed his life. And Ernest Hemingway, who was also a serious alcoholic, said, you know, when I first met Fitzgerald, his writing was as natural as birds singing. It was just what he did. And he loved it, and it was a pure gift. And he said, but you know, as all the critics said, oh, he's a very serious writer. He's very important. He began to lose it. And this happens all the time. You know, it happens in music, in the world of music. It happens in the arts. You know, often being discovered, quote unquote, is the worst thing that can happen to people. And it's not that they suddenly are seen on the street and everybody goes, can I have your autograph? It's that their existence becomes inauthentic because they can no longer be spontaneous and natural. You know, and there's something wonderful about knowing that our existence has no goal, that there's nothing to be achieved. There's nothing to be achieved. If you came to Zen and if the teacher said, this is all about enlightenment, there are stages to enlightenment, and you've got to go through each stage, and you've got to go and push hard, man, push hard. You know, I want to see you go, 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 and make it to the top, you know? Everybody would say, oh, of course, you know, this is good for me. This is training, you know? I'll be better, a better, you know, executive, I'll be better, you know, whatever. And that would be familiar. And, you know, I have the feeling maybe that woman last night wouldn't have left. You know, she'd go, I recognize this, you know. A long time ago, I'll wrap it up, but a woman came to sit with us at the university. And she came and she was the most wonderful woman, and she said, you know, I've opened a new store and I've come here to do meditation because I need help. I've got a lot of stress. And I'm hoping that meditation will make me successful. And I said, and I know what it's like. My brother was a small businessman before his death, and he had incredible tension all the time. You know, I work for the state of New Jersey, you know, and that's rock solid, of course. You know, that was a joke. But at least I get a check every 2 weeks, you know, unless the state goes bankrupt, which could never happen. I'll keep getting the check. But, you know, when you have your own business, you know, you might not get the check. It might fold, you know, so it's incredibly stressful. So this woman said, you know, I'm here because I've got my new business and I want to be a success and I think Zen will make me a success. And I said, you know, I hated to say it, you know, but I felt I needed to say it. I said, well, you know, Zen will help you whether you're a success or not. And that was the last time she ever came. But my feeling is that Zen wouldn't be liberating if I had said, "You bet, you know, it's going to make you make $1 billion. You'll be." Maybe it would work. You know, maybe she would make $1 million. You know, but you know, there's something special about the purposelessness of this. About the, it wouldn't be free, it wouldn't be natural, it wouldn't be real and truthful, you know, if there were a purpose. Because life, I mean, the view is life has no purpose. And the Buddha says that again and again, you know. He'll say something like, actually, there is no such thing as samsara. In the Diamond Sutra, he says, really, samsara is just a word. And somebody said, well, what about enlightenment? I said, well, you know, enlightenment is actually just a word. You know, and somebody says in the Diamond Sutra, somebody asked the Buddha, well, isn't the Buddha special? Can't you tell he's a Buddha? Can't you look at him and you see, you know, his eyes are glowing and you can just see And the Buddha says, you know, if you could spot the Buddha that way, he wouldn't be the Buddha. You know, he'd just be an extraordinary person, but a Buddha isn't just an extraordinary person. He's somebody who knows about dolce fa niente. It doesn't say that in the Dhamma Sutra. But it means that. So I'm so glad you came here to practice, to play this beautiful game of Zen, to be in the moment with the world unconditionally. And I know, if this is your first sesshin, that your legs must hurt an awful lot. And let me just tell you, my legs hardly ever hurt. Okay? And I'm not rubbing it in. I want you to know that what you're experiencing right now is a temporary condition. And that the day will come when you can't wait for sesshin, if you hang in there, and you can't wait to get on the cushion. And I swear to you, that's the truth. And so, you know, please realize it's difficult now. Focus on your breath. Keep your mind riveted on your breath. Every time you follow the breath out, you'll notice that your pain recedes. And then when you take the breath in again, it comes back. But if you keep sweeping the pain away with your breath, it will finally, you'll drop into a place that's absolutely imperturbable. I swear to you, that's the truth. So hang in there. And now let's live in this beautiful freedom.